8. The baseball field. January 2014 through February 2014. Late one Sunday in February 2014, Lucero Sanchez was at home alone in the house in Culiacan where she had been installed by Chapo Guzman when she received a message that the kingpin wanted to see her. That's often how it was when you were the mistress of an international drug lord. Mistresses were expected to accommodate themselves to Guzman's busy schedule. He wanted them to be on call, around the clock, awaiting orders like any other member of the staff. Small and dark-haired, like most of the women in her lover's life, Lucero obeyed the summons. Leaving her house in Guadalupe, she made her way to another house in another neighborhood, Colonia Libertad, which lay closer to the banks of the brown Jumaya River. When Lucero arrived in Libertad, she found the kingpin waiting at his table and joined him for a private meal, served to them, as always, by one of the maids who traveled with him everywhere he went. Their romantic evening didn't last long. Shortly after they sat down, Guzman's bodyguard rushed in and announced that the boss should leave. As Condor, Lucero knew him well, ran outside to start the car, Guzman hurried up and collected his belongings. He told Lucero that he had to run some errands, but that once he was done, he would send his man Nariz, the nose, to get her. Then, without any further explanation, he was gone. That, too, was often how it was. Guzman had a habit of abruptly disappearing. In recent weeks, in fact, his distractions must have seemed especially intense. Lucero may have noticed that since the fall, the kingpin had been living in a kind of protracted panic. People around him kept getting arrested. First, it was his old friend Alex Cifuentes, then it was Serafin, Mayo Zambada's son. There had even been a close call with two of his own sons who were dining out in Culiacan one night when the military pulled into the restaurant's parking lot. With characteristic caution, Damaso Lopez had begun to worry there were snitches in the organization. Fingers, he called them, whom he believed were secretly sending their BlackBerry pins to the authorities. Damaso recommended changing the pins more often and taking other measures like avoiding public meetings. The atmosphere of crisis had only gotten worse when reports arrived in January that a unit of Marines had moved into a naval base in La Paz. After that, there were daily, sometimes hourly, updates, keeping the boss informed about the placement of their helicopters and the movement of their troops. Lucero was surely used to this by now. She had been dating Guzman, if that was the word, for slightly more than 3 years. The two had been introduced at a party in the mountains in late 2010 and had quickly realized that they were both from Sinaloa and shared an upbringing rooted in the region's rural hardships. Lucero was from Cosala, a farming village a few hundred miles from Guzman's birthplace in La Tuna. Like he himself, she had gone to work as a child. Her first job, at 8 years old, was selling empanadas on the street. By 10, she was in her family's crop fields, tending to the corn and tomatoes with her parents. Though she later trained as a kindergarten teacher, she quit her career to marry a man from Tepehuanes, a poor part of Durango, where the economy was based almost entirely on growing marijuana. Lucero's husband, a small-time dealer, beat her and she left him. At the time, she was barely out of her teens. When she met Guzman a few years later, she was 21 and he was 53. She must have been flattered when the world-famous drug lord showed her around the gathering in the mountains. In many respects, she was still a child at that point, working in a beauty salon and devoted to her family, while he was a wealthy celebrity with a global empire of thousands of employees. Everybody knew who Chapo Guzman was, knew about the ballads that were written in his honor, and knew that movie stars were after him to let them tell his story. Lucero even knew there was a bounty on his head. $5 million, people whispered. But she didn't seem to mind. After the party, the kingpin did what he would often do with women who caught his eye. One day, a man approached Lucero and handed her a BlackBerry. The device, he said, was from El Señor and had been specially fixed so that they could speak securely. When Guzman called her, that same day or shortly after, He suggested that he wanted a relationship. What that turned out to mean was that the two of them saw each other once or twice a month. For a woman with Lucero's history, it must have been alluring, nonetheless, to have been thrust into a world of beachfront mansions and cloak and dagger secrecy, and their bond began to deepen, or at least it did from her side. By the end of that first year, she began to think of herself as the kingpin's partner, or what she called his home wife. She hemmed his pants, stocked his shelves with toiletries, and went on little shopping trips to be certain that he always had new clothes. Before long, there were other tasks as well. In late 2011, Guzman began to send her into the mountains on business missions to purchase marijuana. Meeting with local growers, men like her ex-husband, Lucero negotiated quantities and prices and arranged to have his product shipped back to Culiacan below. It was dangerous work, requiring hours of navigating narrow roads and avoiding both the army and jealous rival dealers. But familiar with the people and the landscape, Lucero soon proved worthy. What she lacked in cunning, she usually made up for in devotion, stamping the kilos she acquired for her boyfriend with the logo of a heart. She seemed to think that she was doing God's work, not just Guzman's, bringing a steady income to the campesinos she had known her entire life. Perhaps that sustained her as she crossed the highlands for days on end, staying in her car so long she sometimes fell asleep behind the wheel. In spite of her exhaustion, she always found time to write the kingpin love notes in the evening, even if it meant she had to scramble up a hillside to be sure she got reception. 9:22 p.m.
I want you to be proud of me, and I want you to know that from where I stand in front of the Virgin, that I truly love you and miss you. If there's a way for you and I to be together forever, I'll be the happiest woman in the world.
After their demoralizing failure at Duck Dynasty, Donovan and his crew at SOD went back to work. For the better part of the next 3 weeks, as the ground team in Mexico waited for instructions and a fresh round of intelligence, they plugged into the wiretap machine from dawn until dusk, until dawn again, sifting through its intercepts for any new leads or promising opportunities. After January 20th, it was basically nonstop, Donovan said. We were going home to sleep for a couple of hours and coming right back. But even then, with the target still at large, no one really slept. By early February, their grueling days and endless nights started to pay off. Guzman was still avoiding Pichiguila, but the coalition had not lost sight of his bodyguard, Condor. From the moment that Nogales had identified Condor as the top tier of the pyramid, they had been tracking his movements, pinning and pinging his coordinates through SOD with varying degrees of precision. Sometimes they had him in their sights, sometimes they did not, but all of the signals, when they managed to obtain them, came back to the same location, a single block in a seedy section of Culiacan called Colonia Libertad. If Condor was indeed at Guzman's side, then the block in Libertad could replace Duck Dynasty as the primary target. Again, however, it was not the only target. After Duck Dynasty, SOD had thrown the wiretap machine into overdrive. So much information was pouring in to so many different wire rooms from so many different Blackberries that it now seemed possible to make a play for Mayo Zambada, too, with the Marines impatient to strike at something, anything. Pressure was mounting to get what could be gotten and attempt assaults on both of the leaders simultaneously. The focused operation, which late in January had seemed on the edge of ruin, was suddenly expanded into a complicated, double-barreled mission. The coalition decided to go after Guzman and Zambada at the same time, fixing on whichever one jumped first. Ultimately, Mayo jumped first. On the morning of February 13th, the wire in New York picked up Mayo's trigger after spying on his maids. A lavish spread of Mexican food, the eavesdroppers determined, had just been ordered from the kitchens of his main estate at El Alamo, on the southern edge of Culiacan, and was on its way to a smaller ranch deeper in the countryside. The home-cooked meals, enough to feed at least a dozen people, suggested that Zambada had settled at the ranch with his security team. As soon as the intelligence came in, Donovan, and the agents in New York, relayed it to Vasquez, who quickly passed it on to the Marines. Late that afternoon, four Marine Blackhawks with 40 troops on board took off from the Navy base in La Paz and veered across the Sea of Cortez for the two-hour flight to the target zone. Another 50 Marines had trundled into pickup trucks and were closing in on Mayo to support the operation from the ground. Despite the show of force and the good intelligence, the raid on Mayo was another failure. When the Marines descended on the ranch, accompanied by Maxwell and Vasquez, all they found was a caretaker, some baseball hats in a cupboard, and an arsenal of automatic rifles buried in the yard. Donovan had to hand it to the wise old man. After learning of the plans at Pichiguila, Mayo had packed his bags and hurried off to his fortress in the country. The remote location near El Alamo was no doubt guarded not only by his gunmen, but by sharp-eyed crews of lookouts, or halcones. It was all but assured that as the strike team neared the property, Mayo would be tipped off in advance. Guzman had opted for a different path, taking refuge in his own sort of fortress, his citadel in Culiacan. Having missed Zambada, the coalition pivoted again and refocused its attention on the city. The only question was, who was going to go in there and get him? No one relished the idea of walking into the lion's den. The Marines, who would be downrange, were especially apprehensive. The best of the best, even they, had never planned for a mission inside Culiacan, where Guzman could go anywhere at any time with absolute impunity. The coalition argued that its intercepts were solid. It was true, they didn't have a street address for Guzman yet, but the pings on Condor's phone were tight and frequent, and rarely strayed from the block in Libertad. After the raid on Mayo, they admitted, some of Guzman's office-level filters had gone silent, but most of his BlackBerry network was still transmitting messages. There was one more thing that argued for a quick assault on Culiacan. The wiretap machine had recently been seeing hints that Guzman was building tunnels in the city. One of the tunnels seemed to be connected to a safe house in a web of similar houses, all of which were clumped in Colonia Libertad and the nearby neighborhood of Guadalupe, not far from Culiacan Baseball Stadium. For now, at least, the coalition was convinced that Guzman was living in the area, the baseball field, they called it. But once his tunnels were built, it was impossible to know if that would last. After weighing their options and vetting the intelligence, the Marines decided they were in. Donovan, ecstatic, began to deploy the coalition's forces. Once again, he and his analysts at SOD would ride herd on the wiretap machine and remain on hand in Virginia to flip any pins discovered in the raid into GPS coordinates. Hogan and Healy were headed up the coast to a military base on the Gulf of California, where they would stay in touch with their colleagues in Nogales and feed the ground team the latest rounds of intercepts. At the tip of the spear, Vasquez and Maxwell would slip into the lion's den to conduct reconnaissance with a small group of Marines. Maxwell had the crucial job. Riding out front in an unmarked car with some of the Marines, he planned to drive a grid through the baseball field, setting up his snooping gear to pinpoint Condor's phone. Trailing in a second car, Vasquez and more Marines would provide security, ensuring that as Maxwell found a door to hit, nobody got killed. The ground team breached the city limits on the afternoon of February 16th, almost immediately. The Kingpin's lookout spotted them. Phones started dropping up and down the pyramid as alerts went out through Guzman's network that the Marines and the Gringos were in Culiacan. Everyone assumed that Condor's phone would soon drop too, but Maxwell was having trouble finding it. The signal seemed to be coming and going as if Condor were moving in and out of range or in and out of tunnels. As darkness fell, the worst occurred. The police pulled them over. In a city like Culiacan, it was all but certain they would be on Guzman's payroll. The Marines weren't having it. Stepping from the trail car, one of their officers stood astride the threatening glare of headlights and, cradling his semi-automatic, advised the cops to go about their business. When the police drove off, Vasquez was impressed. Their search, however, was over. Condor had caught wind of them by that point. Bursting in on Guzman's dinner with Lucero Sanchez, he had already rushed the boss from the house in Libertad. Alone in Libertad, Lucero waited. It was not unusual that Guzman and his bodyguard had hurried off and left her on her own, but it must have seemed a little strange that, after they had told her to stay put, the errand boy, Nariz, had still not come to pick her up. The young man, with his funny face and deferential manner, always obeyed the boss's orders. Biding her time a little longer, Lucero did the same. Eventually, she got new orders, but not from Nariz. One of the kingpin's maids called. That was strange as well, and told Lucero, strange again, to leave the house in Libertad and go to a different house, back in Guadalupe, where her night had begun. When Lucero found the address on Humaya Street, it was a house she'd never seen before, and she thought she had seen all of Guzman's houses. This second house in Guadalupe was a modern beige two-story with two garage ports and a security camera posted at its door. It seemed ordinary in all respects but one. It sat behind a funeral home. Guzman was there to welcome her. In one of his expansive moods, he showed her the kitchen and the swimming pool outside, then led her in to the upstairs master bedroom. Within an hour, he had fallen silent. Lying next to him, alone again, Lucero couldn't sleep. There was a reason why Nariz had not showed up that night. The Marines had already arrested him. After they were stopped by the police in Libertad, Vasquez and Maxwell had given up on Condor. Condor, they decided, was much too slippery and Culiacan too hot. Dropping back to their command post in a cornfield north of the city, they huddled in the darkness, running over options with the Marine commanders. If they could not find Condor, the man at Guzman's side, there had to be someone else who knew where he was hiding. As midnight neared, it came to them. The errand boy Nariz, the nose. Nogales went looking for intelligence. Scouring their wire, they saw Nariz had gone that night to a block party near one of Guzman's houses in the baseball field. When Maxwell got them to the party, tracking Nariz's phone, the ground team found a few dozen people drinking under the stars on a noisy street blocked by a pair of SUVs. The Marines moved in on the festivities, pulling aside the women and lining up the men in single file. As Vasquez walked down the row of anxious suspects, something caught his eye. Another woman, off on her own, was hurrying toward a house across the street. Instinct told him, follow her. When the Marines burst into the house, they found Nariz hiding in the bedroom with his BlackBerry. A spot check showed its PIN was a match for the number that Nogales had been tracking. Vasquez had never met Nariz before, but the man in front of him just had to be the nose. His nose was enormous, rising from his upper lip almost to the middle of his brow. Where's he at? Vasquez barked. I want to know where he's at right now. He's at the three, Nariz blurted out. It was one of Guzman's hideouts. Vasquez knew he was lying. He already had the message from Nogales. Fresh off the wire, it had come in only minutes ago. Guzman was at a different house, the five. When Vasquez confronted the nose, he dropped his head and a long sigh cleared his chest of breath. See, he admitted, looking up. The boss was at the five, where Lucero Sanchez finally fell asleep. When the news reached Donovan in Virginia, it was nearly 3 a.m. By that point, he and his worn-out team at SOD had been working for more than 20 hours straight. But all hands hit the deck. They were electrified by the ground team's latest field report. Vasquez and Maxwell had tracked down the errand boy, Nariz. The next part was almost too good to be true. Nariz was going to help them find the five. The nose had given them a block on Humaya Street, in the Guadalupe district near the San Martin funeral home, but he either didn't know or was too scared to provide the exact address. He was claiming he would recognize the house when he saw it, and the coalition set about confirming his account. Nogales checked again on Condor's phone, and it seemed to be back online. Maxwell was able to ping its new location off a cell tower in the neighborhood. The ground team had also found a cache of BlackBerry pins in the call logs of Narisa's phone, and the analysts at SOD fed them to the wiretap machine, hoping to find corroborating intercepts or connections to Guzman's other phones. Racing down to Culiacan from their base up the coast, Hogan and Healy sent out a group text with another little tidbit. They had both remembered that earlier in the day, the wire in Arizona had overheard Guzman sending Nariz to the Five to meet his pool guy. It wasn't much, but it was something. The Five had a pool. During all of this, Vasquez and Maxwell had been on the ground in Culiacan with the Marine commanders, sketching out the plans of an operation. It had come together quickly, if not much more than an hour's time, but Donovan approved. Given the Kingpin's talent for escape, the Marines had quietly surrounded Humaya Street with a perimeter of troops and laid out a barricade of tire spikes on several nearby blocks. To maintain their edge of surprise, they were now proposing to approach the target block in two small, ordinary cars. The first car was Nariz's, and it was a clicker for the Five's garage door. Nariz himself, with one of the Marines at the wheel of the car, was prepared to lead the second car, with Vasquez and more Marines inside, slowly down the street, and hit the clicker as they reached the right house. When the garage door opened, the rest of the strike force lying in wait would converge. If the plan was not ideal, Donovan understood it was the best that could be hoped for. Working on the fly, in the middle of the morning, with everyone exhausted, he didn't want to crowd his men, but could not resist checking in with them as they finalized the details. Was Condor's phone still pinging on the block in Guadalupe? Was Nariz still cooperative? Did the clicker still work? I knew they had a job to do, he said, but I remember thinking, this is it. At 4 a.m., the signal came. Mission imminent. In another few minutes, he would lose them. The group chat buzzed with updates. Perimeter secure, strike force standing by, cars now turning on Humaya Street. Just before his world went dark, Donovan got the final text. The garage door was open. The men with battering rams were going in. Lucero woke up to the pounding. The heavy thuds and the calm of early morning jolted her from bed. When she got up and went to the window, she might not have believed what she was seeing. Humaya Street was jammed with lights and vehicles. Helicopters hovered overhead. Guzman had barely stirred, but beside him on the nightstand, one of his security monitors showed a hive of grainy shapes slamming at the reinforced door in his garage. Looking closer, Lucero made out men in hoods and helmets. Soldiers, she thought, forcing their way inside. Tio, uncle, open up. Tio, they're on us, Condor was banging on the door. Jolted up himself now, Guzman ran to let him in, then hurried toward the bathroom. As Lucero ran after him, followed by the maid, there was another unreal sight. The Kingpin, naked, was prying up one end of his bathtub. Standing in the shower, he had popped the basin open like a car hood, exposing the giant hole that lay beneath it. In the hole, Lucero saw was a wooden ladder descending through the floor. Come with me, Guzman shouted. Come. She couldn't believe he wanted her to go in there, but he was already halfway down and, with little choice, she started down herself. The humidity hit her instantly, a damp heat laced with the stench of sewage. At the bottom of the ladder, she realized that they were in a tunnel. Up ahead, Guzman was cranking at the handle of a huge steel door that blocked their path, shouting out to Condor to hurry up and help him. When the two men forced it open, the three of them, with the maid in tow, raced into the sewers. Lucero was traumatized. The air was rank, the ceilings low, there was barely any light. She could feel a pool of water covering her ankles and a coat of oozing sludge beneath her feet. Rushing off, Guzman and Condor left her with the maid. Soon they were out of sight. Alone now, the two women stumbled through the darkness, following the filthy concrete walls. Humaya Street had erupted into chaos. Up and down the block, the Marines were running riot, ripping up manhole covers and stopping random strangers. Their radios blared. Their captains shouted orders. One of their hand grenades exploded in the five. Vasquez ran into the house with the second wave of the strike team and saw it when he reached the kingpin's bathroom. Guzman's bathtub had been levered open at 45 degrees on a set of hydraulic hinges. Underneath it, a ladder led through a trap door in the floor. Some of the Marines were down there now, pressing the chase and calling back that they could hear him. When Vasquez scrambled down to join them, they had already turned around. 10 feet forward, past a huge steel door, they were saying it was bajo, muy bajo. They couldn't get much farther in. The tunnel was just too low. Vasquez grabbed one of the captains. If the men went back, he said, without their long guns and their vests this time, maybe they could make it. The captain wasn't keen on the idea, but once he thought it over, he asked for volunteers. All of them volunteered. At the mouth of the tunnel, Vasquez watched the Marines stripping off their body armor and strapping on their pistols. Vaya con Dios. Go with God, he told each one as they headed back down. Finally, the exit. Lucero could see it now, relieved. It was a large stone drainage gate where the sewer spilled into the river. Guzman and Condor were waiting there for her and the maid. One by one, they stepped into the water, wading through the shallows toward a small embankment, then clambering up through the bushes to the street. Condor, on his phone, was already making calls to get them out of there. When he reached his friend Picudo, Guzman's chief enforcer in the city, he ordered him to come at once and gave him their location. They seemed to be somewhere near the Federalismo Bridge. Back on land, the kingpin was panicked. He had been naked since he fled the house in Guadalupe and now gave orders for everyone to strip right there on the riverbank and give him their dry clothes. There wasn't time to wait for Picudo, he was saying. The troops were on their tail. They had to steal a car. But there wasn't one to steal. They were on a small road in the darkness at 4 in the morning, with nothing much around except a few locked houses and the National Water Office. Picudo was the best chance they had, perhaps their only chance, and he was already on his way. An hour after the strike team discovered Guzman's tunnel, the men in the field finally came to life. Maxwell started to answer Donovan's group chats, if single words were actually an answer. In the heat of the chase, there wasn't much he could report. What do you got? Nothing. You have him yet? Negative. You talk about pins and needles, Donovan said. For a drug agent, for anyone, this is the highest point you'll reach in your career. The lowest point arrived at 7 in the morning in Virginia, when Donovan got the text he had been hoping to avoid. We missed him. He's in the wind. Everyone at SOD knew what was coming next. All of the Blackberries they'd been tracking would be dumped. They were going to lose the wiretap machine. It was Donovan's first real taste of Guzman's cunning. He did not like it. It seemed the man knew everything that was going on around him. He knew that the Marines were coming. He knew where they were going. He even knew that his own men had been with them. That kind of savvy, Donovan thought, that kind of awareness, only came with protection at the highest levels. The one good piece of news that morning was Nariz. After leading the ground team to the five, Nariz had taken them on a dawn-light tour of Culiacan. Driving them through the baseball field, he showed them Guzman's 4 other safe houses, each one connected by a similar bathtub tunnel. Moving on, he led them to warehouses, stash houses, and several private houses, among them Condor's home, and a large house filled with modern art that belonged to Guzman's ex-wife Griselda. When the tour was over, the kingpin's local infrastructure was in shambles. The Marines had seized 30 high-end vehicles and an arsenal of RPGs and automatic weapons. They had found Guzman's own weapon, a pistol with his initials monogrammed in diamonds on the handle. They even found a crate of plastic bananas, each one loaded with a filling of cocaine. Donovan had gotten reports about all of that, too, but it didn't take the sting out. He was still out there, waiting to be found. If only somebody could find him. pulling up in a red sedan at shortly after 4 a.m., Picudo, the enforcer, had found him by the river. As the boss piled into the car with Condor and the women, Picudo was told where they were going. Mazatlan, one of Guzman's other stronghold cities, farther down the coast. At a high rate of speed, it is a two-hour drive from Culiacan to Mazatlan, the shortest route being Highway 15D. The sun, then, would have just been coming up when the fugitives were dropped at a beach resort north of the city center, a dawn-light tour of their own. It was one of Donovan's analysts who noticed it. As the day ground on in Chantilly, he realized that the man they knew as Picudo had been moving. San Diego had been tracking Picudo since the summer, and everyone was a bit surprised that even after the close call at the 5, he hadn't dropped his BlackBerry. According to Picudo's pings that morning, he had been in Culiacan at 4 a.m., then he was in Mazatlan at 6. What caught the analyst's eye was what happened after that. The pings made it fairly clear that after going down to Mazatlan, Picudo had turned around and come straight back. SOD was trying to figure it out. Picudo was one of Guzman's most trusted soldiers, his chief enforcer and plaza boss in Culiacan. Why, they wondered, had he gone to Mazatlan at all? And why had his trip been so abrupt? Only one reason. He had taken Guzman to Mazatlan. Donovan was on the phone at once with Brian Maxwell. Brian, he begged, you have to drop to Mazatlan. Maxwell, after hearing the news, agreed. We'll lift and shift, he said. Before they did, however, there was one more job to do in Culiacan. They had to pay a visit to Picudo. Manuel López Osorio, better known as Picudo, was fast asleep at his modest ranch house on the western edge of Culiacan, not far from the airport. The past 2 days had been exhausting. On Monday morning, the day before, Picudo had been woken at a little after 4 by his old friend Condor with panicked orders to fetch him and the boss near Segunda Street by the river. When he rushed to pick them up, he learned he was to hurry them and the women they were with to Mazatlan, a two-hour drive down the Sinaloa coast. Stopping at a turnoff on the highway, Picudo had passed his charges at shortly after dawn to his counterpart in Mazatlan, Bravo Aponte, who oversaw the city for the kingpin. Then, with his mission finished, he received new orders, turn around and head back up to Culiacan. Stranger things had happened to Picudo over the years. The one strange thing about that trip, he remembered, had been Guzman himself, who had seemed a little out of sorts and sullener than usual. Or so he said, at 2 on Tuesday morning, when a group of armed Marines, arriving with the gringos, broke through his door and arrested him in bed. The arrest of Picudo and his subsequent confession, early on the morning of February 18th, was the coalition's best evidence yet that after fleeing the 5, Guzman had in fact left Culiacan and taken refuge in his second city, Mazatlan. It was not, however, their only evidence at that point. Even at that fragile phase of the search, the wiretap machine was seeing more activity than Donovan had expected. Hours earlier, San Diego had picked up hints that another one of Guzman's gunmen, alias Popeye, was also in Mazatlan, perhaps to augment his security team. Separate intercepts suggested that infusions of cash, lots of cash, were on their way to Bravo Aponte, the kingpin's local plaza boss. While Donovan had quite a bit that was pointing him toward Mazatlan, what he did not have yet was a target in the city, a busy port town with a crowded coastline, an international airport, and more than 400,000 residents. His colleagues in Nogales were pinning their hopes on a powerful new tool for homing in on Condor, who still remained the best chance for homing in on Guzman. For weeks now, the team in Arizona had been working with Andrea Goldberg, a prosecutor in Washington, D.C., to obtain what was called a roving wiretap on the kingpin's bodyguard. Roving wires permit investigators to follow specific subjects, not just their devices, meaning that no matter how often Condor changed his PIN or dumped his phone, Nogales would be able to stay with him. Though the team was getting close to its approval, the process was notoriously difficult, and no federal judge had ever given permission for a roving wire on foreign soil. As Nogales waited eagerly to hear from Chambers, Donovan and his own team had undertaken a different way of tracking down the kingpin. They had asked the wiretap machine and the intelligence community to spy on Guzman's maids. After almost a month of 24-hour days, a marathon that had begun in January with the planning at Duck Dynasty, what they all really needed was a break. If they didn't take one, it was only because their target hadn't taken one, and they felt that he was near the end of his rope. "Sometimes it's better having someone try to run from you," Donovan said, "because that's when they expose themselves. When you run, you make mistakes." It is unlikely that anyone paid much attention when the old man in the wheelchair was rolled into the Hotel Miramar in Mazatlan that Friday by a younger man who may have been his son. The pale pearl condominium tower, a 12-story pile on the Avenue del Mar near the beach, was, with its discount rates, a haven for retirees and tourists. Rental leases in places like the Miramar tend to be relaxed affairs. They are often agreed upon informally, settled both quickly and in cash. There was, of course, a register for the hotel's guests and tenants, but all it said on that day, February 21st, was that the young man taking apartment 401 was named Alon. When the judge in Arizona formally approved the roving wire on Condor, Vasquez, Maxwell, and Hogan were on their way to Mazatlan with a small group of Marines. It was February 21st, a good day. To confuse the halcones, the lookouts, all of them had stopped before leaving Culiacan at a Soriana discount store, where they traded in their uniforms for flip-flops and board shorts, as if they were sunseekers headed to the beach. Driving south, they split up on the highway, moving one car at a time. For extra security, they had commandeered vehicles that had been seized that week during the raids on Guzman's armored fleet. Word of the roving wire reached them on the road at more or less the same time it reached Donovan at SOD. Hogan immediately pinged Condor's number in one of Guzman's cars. Donovan pinged it at his office in Virginia. Both came back with the same rough set of coordinates. The Hotel Miramar, a pale pearl condominium tower in Mazatlan on the Avenue del Mar. It wasn't much, apartment 401. A kitchen, a sitting room, a little front hall alcove and a pair of small bedrooms, but at the rate they were paying, Señor Alon and the old man in the wheelchair could make do. It soon got crowded in the fourth floor suite, however. Later that day, the old man's wife, or was it his daughter, came to join him. She was not alone, having brought along her two baby girls, the nanny and a maid. As he drove past the Miramar after getting into Mazatlan that evening, Brian Maxwell's snooping equipment registered a hit. Condor's phone was in the building. The target was confirmed. At work at SOD that night, Donovan was in his usual state of high anxiety. His own job was finished. Now it was the ground team's job to bring Guzman in. As he had done with Culiacan just days before, he had talked with Vasquez and Maxwell about how they planned to hit the hotel's door. Over the years, Donovan had made plenty of his own plans to hit plenty of his own doors. He knew that he was working with the best, but he also knew that well-laid plans and well-placed doors sometimes didn't work. The ground team and the Marine commanders settled in at a large white house in a residential district of the city, far from the noise and neon of the waterfront. For Mazatlan, it was quite the palace, with a Greek facade and a pleasant courtyard garden. After ordering pizzas, the excited men went to bed at 10. If the halcones found them here, they deserved to get a bonus. The following morning, they set out in the dark at 4 a.m. From their makeshift base, it was two long turns to the Avenue del Mar. When their trucks pulled up beneath the line of palm trees in front of the Hotel Miramar, Victor Vasquez, no doubt thinking of Cabo, immediately sent a few Marines around to the back. He posted others by the swimming pool and underneath the tall facade of balconies. His orders to them could not have been clear. He wanted to be notified at once if anyone so much as poked their head out. The only problem with the mission, as far as he could tell, was the size of the strike team the Marines had brought. 24 men, stretched thin, past his liking. Okay, he thought as the perimeter was set and he glanced up at the building. He's got to be in there somewhere. Somewhere, yes, but where? According to the guest register, two new groups of tenants had arrived the day before. One was a certain Señor Alon, who was staying on the fourth floor with his family. The other was a pair of younger men with Anglo-sounding names, who had taken a sixth-floor luxury apartment overlooking the water. Some on the ground team reasoned that the famous drug lord, Chapo Guzman, would obviously take the room with views. But then there was an alternate theory. Perhaps he was avoiding deluxe accommodations in favor of laying low. Somewhere, yes. But where? Luz verde. Green light. And the hour before dawn. Sitting in Virginia, his world gone dark again, Donovan couldn't help but wonder, was it possible to build a tunnel under a hotel? Luxury won. After crashing through the door of the sixth floor Ocean View apartment, the strike team of Marines found two young stoners sleeping off a night of smoky revels. They were scared to death, of course, and at least, at first, not entirely coherent. But under the tonic of an armed interrogation, they were absolutely certain about one thing. They had nothing to do with Chapo Guzman. The ground team was unsure. There was weed in their room, and that was something. But one of the stoners was clearly an American. He even had a California medical marijuana card. Had Guzman started using trained American killers as his bodyguards? Unsure. On the fourth floor, meanwhile, Señor Alon was asleep in the front hall alcove near the door. In the smaller bedroom on separate beds were the two young girls, the nanny and the maid. Down the hall in the master suite, the old man slept beside the woman, his wheelchair no longer needed, safely stowed in the sitting room. In bed together. So clearly not his daughter then. His wife. Brian Maxwell, a proponent of the alternate theory, sat on the front steps of the Hotel Miramar, his back bent, head in hands. It was happening again. They were going to lose him again. The main Marine strike team had tied itself in knots with a couple of harmless dopers while the world's most wanted criminal was two floors beneath them, perhaps cocking his rifle, if he was even still there. The street outside was flooded with activity by now. Mazatlan was rising. And no one seemed to be listening, until Maxwell found a Marine lieutenant who finally called his captain. When he ran him through the situation, the captain nodded, giving him a handful of men. New target, apartment 401. In and up they went. They didn't need a battering ram this time. The door was that flimsy. Marinas! Condor had a weapon. But stepping from the alcove near the front door, he lowered it at once. In the smaller bedroom, the maid, the nanny, and the little girls, their matching pink suitcases, lying on the floor. Racing back toward the master bedroom, the Marines found Guzman's wife, Emma Coronel, alone in bed. "Don't kill him," she pleaded, looking toward the bathroom. "Please, don't kill him." Guzman had dashed toward the toilet with a Bushmaster semi-automatic. His wife screamed not to shoot him. The Marines, their rifles leveled, told him to come out. Okay. All right. Bueno. He was coming out. On Vasquez's radio, the confirmation signal. Siete, siete, siete. They had him. They had him? He ran toward the hotel's underground garage. In the custody of the Mexican Marines were Carlos Hu Ramirez, also known as Condor. Emma Coronel Aispuro, Chapo Guzman's wife, one of the kingpin's maids, alias Chaparra, and the nanny charged with caring for his two young daughters, Kiki and Emalia. When Vasquez came around the corner, hurrying down the garage's spiral driveway, he saw Guzman kneeling on the asphalt, shirtless and surrounded by Marines. Holy shit, he thought. It's really him. As Vasquez approached, someone took a photograph. Standing over Guzman, he whispered to his target,
Eres tú.
It's you. When news of the capture was blasted out on the coalition's group chat, Donovan, the words did not do justice, was elated. We were just on top of the world, he said, basically like kids in a candy store. Everyone was congratulating one another, getting a little giddy. Hey man, couldn't have done it without you. But it was true. There was no way the DEA could have done all this alone, or HSI, or the Mexicans. None of us could have done it on our own, Donovan said, but because it was all of us together, it validated all of our work. The photograph, for instance, Donovan had gotten it from Hogan and Maxwell on the ground and quickly passed it on to his team at SOD. From there, it went to the assistant chief and the chief of the division, then on to headquarters in Washington. Flying over agency walls, it sailed toward Justice, Homeland Security, even the FBI, before making a left on Pennsylvania Avenue. There, it finally landed, in the Oval Office of the White House, on the desk of the president himself. Interlude. Chivo Expiatorio. Shackled at the wrists and sandwiched between three Marines in ski masks, the world's most wanted man was on the move. Within hours of his arrest, Guzman was placed on a military Learjet and flown to Mexico City. There, he was presented at a perp walk for reporters in a pair of handcuffs and a crisp white dress shirt. It was not much after noon on a Saturday in February, but seizing on the weekend news, the global media was already in a frenzy. The Associated Press, having gotten the initial tip, was first in reporting that the legendary outlaw was in custody, noting that his larger-than-life persona and his place in Mexican folklore had been unable to assist him this time. To the Telegraph, Guzman was a mythical figure. To El País, he was the most important narco that has ever been. The New York Times paid homage, somewhat staidly, to the drug lord's legend and the mystery of his whereabouts. It also obtained a quote from a source on the ground who shared his opinions on Guzman's ambiguous ontology. He was somebody who existed, this philosophical man on the street explained, and didn't exist. In the welter of words and images that day, it wasn't the worst description. His own kind of centaur, half man, half make-believe, the kingpin had always occupied the hazy space that sat between reality and fairy tale. It was often impossible with Chapo Guzman to know where the folklore ended and the facts began. The anecdotes about his life and crimes had been passed from hand to hand so often, they had finally acquired the edgeless quality of fables. Was it really true, as the newspaper said, that during his early days in the mountains, he would come down out of hiding for lavish meals in Culiacan and have his men collect the cell phones of all the other diners in the restaurant? And what about the story he told to Javier Rey about the time that soldiers took him into custody in Nayarit and flew him upside down, hanging him by his ankles from a helicopter? This sort of narrative broad-mindedness was familiar to many in Mexico and was especially well-known in Sinaloa, riven as it was by a tradition of inequality and the sort of social hardships that inspire magical thinking. The particularities of history had prepared the state of Guzman's outsized legend. For more than 100 years, Sinaloa had been ruled by a caste of powerful caciques, local strongmen who nominally ran the region for the federal authorities, but were in practice more like feudal lords, accountable to little beyond their own ambitions and avarice. As the state industrialized in the middle 19th century, their plunders of the poor triggered the emergence of a class of outlaws who often conflated profitable brigandage with political rebellion. Much like Robin Hood had skirmished with and stolen from the landed gentry of Nottinghamshire, men like Heraclio Bernal, 1855 through 1888, and Felipe Bachomo, 1883 through 1916, robbed and revolted against the nobles of Sinaloa. Over time, these real-life radical bandits coalesced in the state's imagination into the single mythic figure of Jesus Malverde, the so-called narco-saint. The legend of Malverde, though historically unverified, is revered in Sinaloa, where it has been handed down from fathers to sons since the moment of its creation. Born in 1870, Malverde was said to have been raised in the region when it was under the thumb of Governor Francisco Cañedo, who carried out a repressive policy of economic expansion for the ruthless dictator Porfirio Díaz. Malverde's parents were apparently so penniless, they starved to death, leaving him to fend for himself in a job on the Mexican railroads, where he was exploited by a string of brutal bosses. Looking for a better life, and perhaps vengeance, he moved to the mountains with a band of hardy men who joined him in his quest to rob from the rich and give to the poor. But Cañedo put a bounty on his head, and one of Malverde's men eventually betrayed him. After his capture in 1909, Malverde was put to death, either shot by a firing squad or hanged by the police. 80 years later, when Chapo Guzman started his career, generations of narco-traffickers had already co-opted Malverde's saga to justify their own business model of stealing, as they saw it, from the drug-addled gringos in the north and repatriating the profits back to Mexico. In this retelling of the story, the narcos, like the bandits of old, were heroes, a ragtag bunch of poor kids from the mountains who slipped across the border and returned with treasures for their families. There is some evidence that as Guzman's fortunes grew, he too shared a portion of his wealth in Sinaloa. He was particularly fond of building churches. But the idea that he, or anyone around him, was engaged in a program of redistributing assets is a fable built upon a fable. Guzman's real progenitors were not Malverde or Robin Hood. They were Houdini and the Roadrunner. For more than a decade before his arrest at the Hotel Miramar, Guzman had been staging public spectacles, enacting evasions and escapes to the glee of many ordinary people who were saddled with a history of abuse and neglect by the authorities. If his magic tricks were not in fact magic, but engineered events, carefully oiled by government graft, it didn't matter, or at least it didn't diminish the schadenfreude-like pleasures of watching him perform his act. And that was what was not getting through in the media frenzy following his capture. The Kingpin's legend wasn't simply based on his enviable fortune or his startling longevity or his time-proven talent for slipping away. It was based on how all of these qualities conspired together to expose the fecklessness and corruption of the government. Every time that Guzman managed to be there one minute, gone the next, it reinforced a pre-existing belief that Mexico's rulers were the fools that everyone assumed them to be. Every dollar that Guzman spent on bribing the authorities had a double purchasing power. It served not only to protect him and his interests, but to prove, as if more proof were needed, that the guardians of the country's body politic were unworthy of its trust. Today, I believe more in El Chapo Guzman than I do in the governments that hide truths from me, Kate del Castillo had tweeted 2 years earlier. After the events in Mazatlan, a perceptive professor said something similar to a Mexican reporter. With the state of things in Mexico, the situation is truly interesting. The idols, the heroes, who should be official figures of moral integrity, decency, and honor, don't exist. That Guzman had been arrested, despite this lack of official integrity, in no way contradicted the idea that on the whole, the Mexican authorities were compromised, nor did it contradict the idea that the American authorities who had helped in his arrest were hindered by their own moral failing, namely a recurrent inability to get along with one another. The capture operation that began near Pichiguila, moved through Culiacán and ended on the Avenue del Mar, was distinguished by its technical expertise and its sheer dogged persistence, but it was also blessed by no small amount of happy accident. With Guzman, it had always been like that. We understood pretty quickly that there was only one way to get him, said Thomas Shakeshaft, a Chicago prosecutor who pursued the kingpin for a decade. It wasn't enough to just be good. You had to be a little lucky, too. And yet, for some suspicious souls, even hard work, leavened by a bit of luck, was not enough to account for the success of getting Guzman off the streets. There had to be something else at play, and in the dark world of the drug war, that usually meant a conspiracy. Even as Guzman was sent to prison, the Mexican media was full of knowing whispers. The kingpin, it was said, had overplayed his hand and had finally lost the trust of his government protectors. Unless, of course, his partner, Mayo Zambada, tired of the heat that he had long brought down on the cartel, had decided to turn him in. There is no shortage of conspiracy theories concerning Chapo Guzman. Discussing the kingpin in an academic treatise on Mexican cartels, the sociologist Jim Creechin correctly notes that it was he, and not the equally guilty Mayo, who first became the face of the international drug trade. To Creechin, Guzman's prominence, reaching back to the early 1990s, presents a paradox, the paradox of visibility, because prominence runs counter to the normal way of mafia bosses, who tend to operate in quiet anonymity. This narco-stardom, as Creechin calls it, suggests that Guzman was actually much less powerful than Mayo, and that he may indeed have been elevated to his celebrated status in order to distract the world from the crimes of other colleagues. Creechin's argument, and he is not alone in making it, goes like this. In 1993, after the assassination of Cardinal Ocampo, Mexico's then-president, Carlos Salinas de Gortari, found himself in an untenable position. Salinas, on the one hand, needed for political reasons to get tough on organized crime and assuage the public outrage that the cardinal's killing had occasioned. On the other hand, Salinas could not be too hard on the traffickers, given the central role they played in his economy, and worse, the information that they had on his own administration's involvement in the drug trade. Caught between this rock and a hard place, Salinas supposedly opted for a third way, diverting the attention of his country onto a chivo expiatorio, or scapegoat. El Chapo Guzman became the sacrificial lamb, Creechin writes. The government, moved to muster evidence that the Chapo Guzman narrative represented the most credible explanation of the murder, and simultaneously and improbably initiated a plan to persuade the world that this insignificant and uneducated man from Mexico's western Sierra Madre was the most important boss of Mexico's most important drug cartel. Following this ritual elevation, everyone apparently went home happy. Salinas, appearing to do something by jailing Guzman for Ocampo's death, reduced the pressure on his government to do too much. Guzman's rivals in the drug trade, among them Mayo Zambada and the Tijuana drug cartel, which had actually killed the cardinal, were spared the pains of a crackdown. Even Guzman seems to have gotten something in the bargain, a payout or trade-off from other cartel leaders for gradually agreeing to accept the blame. As seductive as all of this may be, it suggests the lengths to which otherwise reasonable people will go in trying to explain the allure of Chapo Guzman. A cottage industry has in fact sprung up with the sole goal of accounting for his myth. What often ends up happening is that one myth is substituted for another. If it seems unlikely that an insignificant, uneducated peasant from the Western Sierras could rise to become the maximum boss of the Mexican drug trade, then surely the president of Mexico put him in the post, or his cunning partner maneuvered him into taking it, or Central Intelligence, fearing what he might reveal about its own operations in the country, secretly helped him out along the way. Though perhaps less satisfying as an answer, it could simply be that Guzman's myth arose from the way in which his natural talents for corruption and escape played in front of a specific local audience, one that thrilled to see the government embarrassed. it is certainly the case that Guzman was tenacious and a little lucky, just like the law enforcement officers who tracked him down and captured him. The kingpin was, by all accounts, obsessed with his profession, a workaholic who never shut up about the office. Chapo always talks about the drug business wherever he is, one of his first employees, Miguel Angel Martinez, once said. With whatever people he's with, he's talking about drugs. Guzman also started his career at an auspicious moment. In the early 80s, just as demand for cocaine was reaching its peak in the United States, at the end of the decade, he was further helped when, under pressure from American officials, the Mexican authorities arrested his mentor, Miguel Felix Gallardo, dismantling the old regime and creating space for fresh blood from below. As Guzman found his place in the power structure after Felix Gallardo was imprisoned, NAFTA came along, deregulating the border and ravaging local agriculture. The sudden spike in international trade made it infinitely easier to ship drugs north, hidden in the endless streams of cargo trucks. It also persuaded many farmers to switch to illicit crops or to leave their land for crowded urban slums. There, devoid of options, some began to work for the cartels. Driven by ambition in a booming market filled with opportunity, inventory, and labor, it may not have taken a complicated conspiracy to have launched Guzman into celebrity, especially when he himself relished being celebrated. Just before the Marines swooped down on him in Mazatlan, he had put the finishing touches on the El Padrino movie project. Working with his assistant, Andrea Vélez, he had lovingly assembled an 18-page promotional package for the film, complete with a biography section, Who is Joaquin Guzman Loera?, and a scene-by-scene synopsis of its episodes. The Mexican actor Gael García Bernal had been tentatively cast as the young Chapo Guzman, with John Leguizamo slotted for the supporting role of Pablo Escobar. The paradox of visibility was paradoxical only in the sense that Guzman never wanted to be invisible. He wanted to be seen.